Welcome to the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. Episode 39, Professor Ora Israel. Well, welcome listeners to another episode of the Nuclear Medicine and Molecular Medicine Podcast. If you haven't listened to any episodes before, please go to iTunes and click download all, and you can get all of them. Or you can, if you want to, you can go to the website, that's at nukecast.com, and play them there. Just click next to the play button on each episode. We go back 5 years now. It's one of the longest running serious medical podcasts in the world, if not the oldest. And it's got a lot of interesting stuff, and even our first episode is quite relevant today, so I'm sure you'll find lots of interesting stuff there. And of course, there's been lots of interesting things happening in the world of nuclear medicine. In particular, most of us are going through some problems with molybdenum shortages at the moment. That's affecting most of the Americas and Europe. Hopefully that will be over shortly. There's been announcements that both the European reactor at Pétain and the reactor in Chalk River in Canada is going to be up and running shortly, so I do hope there'll be some help there. There's also been new signs that new sources of technetium are going to come online from Eastern Europe, which have already started to come online from new facilities in Canada and America. And from existing reactors such as those in Australia and South Africa that are ramping up. I'm sure this is all very interesting, and we're going to have another interesting episode coming up in the future to deal with this very topical episode that affects all of us. And there's lots and lots of new things that are happening along those areas, along with some new areas of medicine that that I'm sure you'll find interesting coming up. But of course, we always want new material. We need new material for our podcast. So please, two things you can do. One is just email me. That's rob@nukecast.com. That's rob@nuccast.com. And you can tell me what you think about the podcast, what you like, what you dislike, you know, what you'd like to see. And preferably, perhaps you can help too. There's different ways you can help. The best way you can help is by suggesting people that I can interview for the podcast. I can do that in person if I can get to them, if I'm at a conference or if they're in London where I am, or I can record an interview over Skype, and I'm sure that's that'll work for most people. I can record them on the phone, or I can record them Skype if they've got a proper audio setup to do that at home. So there's lots of ways that I can get podcast there. I'd like to do some video podcasts coming up in the future, and of course I'd also like to do some interactive quizzes to help you with your CPD points. So there's lots of areas which you can help me with the podcast, and if you want to, you can help defray some of the costs of the podcast. There's hosting costs and equipment costs and things like that, and travel costs that are very considerable costs that make the podcast expensive for me to do. So you can donate at nukecast.com if you want to, but you don't have to. It's an entirely free podcast, and I'm just happy that you're listening. And of course, the other way you can help is let other people know about it. I'd like to have lots of people listen so that my work is useful. But let's not get too distracted. We want to get on with the interview today, and this time we're dealing with a very interesting speaker, Professor Ora Israel from Israel. And she's got some very interesting topics to discuss, largely related to where we're heading in the future, particularly with equipment. And Israel's been at the forefront of this for a long time. A lot of the technical equipment that we use, hardware equipment and hardware and software combinations, come from Israel. So I'm sure she'll have lots to tell us about that. So before very let's get on. Further ado, let's get on with the interview with Professor Ora Israel. We're privileged again to have another excellent interview on the podcast from Dr. Professor Ora Israel, who's been doing a large amount of work on hybrid imaging. And she presented a very interesting talk today on hybrid imaging and where the future of that lies. Before I ask questions, perhaps Dr. Israel might like to tell us a little about where she works and her background.
Hi, I'm director of nuclear medicine and PET at the Rambam Healthcare Campus. It is the major hospital in the northern part of Israel. We have a very active nuclear medicine department, which performs over 80 studies a day, and approximately half of them, if not more, are hybrid imaging studies. Our experience with hybrid imaging goes back for the last decade, when we have started with SPECT/CT, and the last 9 years when we work with SPECT/CT.
Yes, and I gather a lot of the very first machines, a lot of the very first equipment was developed in Israel, and particularly from Haifa, which is famous for new developments, particularly in the area of SPECT and PET. A lot of new technologies and new machinery, new equipment, and new detector technology has come from Haifa, from a whole variety of different companies. Perhaps you might, before I ask you some specific questions, perhaps you could talk about some of the hybrid technologies that are out there at the moment and coming online.
Okay, so right now we are working with new SPECT/CT devices, which have some novel images or some novel components born on the SPECT side with the CZT Alcyon technology, with the CZT detectors that enable rapid, fast image acquisition, and with the on the CT part as well, with a wide range of CT capabilities, where you actually as a physician have to make the decision which will suit your range of practice best. PET/CT is as well part of the R&D line in Haifa, Israel. We're still working mainly on software improvements on this device.
Yes. So one of the interesting things you showed, I thought, and I think it's quite relevant in terms of actually making a difference to outcome. There's been lots of talk of hybrid imaging in terms of convenience and in terms of new technology, but actually in terms of clinical outcome, I thought there were some interesting things that you had to say. One in particular was the idea of guided biopsy and improving the outcome with guided biopsy. Perhaps you could talk to us a bit about how hybrid imaging can help with guided biopsies.
Yeah, I believe that this is an area where indeed hybrid imaging can make a huge difference. Unfortunately, at the moment, this has been quite neglected at the level of R&D developments and should be really taken up by some. There is undoubtedly a difference between a biopsy that is guided only by anatomic imaging, where you can see a mass or an enlarged node, an arch organ, but you cannot define where inside this anatomic finding the highest number of active disease cells might be. As compared to guiding biopsy by a hybrid imaging modality, where you have both the anatomic landmarks and the outlines of the finding that needs to be further explored, as well as the functional characterization of these findings, and being able to guide your needle or your invasive procedure directly to the high area which has the highest metabolic activity will, in my opinion, certainly make a huge change in what we call sampling error of biopsy disease tissue.
Yes, you showed some interesting examples of that, but really this could apply in a whole range of carcinomas or even more benign lesions. It's a very important area. Even in infection, I could think that it could actually play a role, because you might be trying to find the particular organism that's causing a problem. If you know where the most active infection is, perhaps it might help. Do you think there's a role in that area as well?
Absolutely. Cancer is where it all started. Cancer is where hybrid imaging in general started. But after the first few years, we knew that we were just scratching the tip of the iceberg, that there is so much more. And infection is undoubtedly the second most important areas. In some parts of the world, it might be even more important than cancer, because infection is so much more widespread. Not only could it be the best way to make diagnosis, but maybe even when you think about a way to remove the infectious process through a puncture, that maybe this should be also for therapeutic purposes being guided by hybrid imaging.
Yeah, absolutely. With increasing numbers of resistant infections, going back to older techniques in terms of surgical techniques to remove infections is becoming more widespread. And to have hybrid imaging, that would really help with that process. One other thing that you talked about in terms of that was use of hybrid imaging and dosimetry. Now, everybody's talking about new therapies in all sorts of ways, not just for cancer, but, for example, Datachova's been talking about therapies for HIV or therapies for a whole range of things, from melanoma to HER2 positive. All of those things are most effective when you give the maximum tolerable dose. How do you think hybrid imaging can help in that area?
We are talking a lot about personalized medicine, about tailoring the treatment to an individual patient, and in practice we're not doing enough in this direction. Being able to have a non-invasive imaging study where you can calculate the using small amounts of the therapeutic agent labeled with a radioactive isotope will, in my opinion, make a huge difference, because it will not be a uniform dose that hoping that your patient will be among the responders. You will be able to decide if this patient will benefit from radiotherapy or with unsealed sources, specifically radioimmunotherapy, which is more evolved these days. And if he's not one of the responders, maybe you could stop wasting precious time and direct the patient to another type of treatment.
Yes, and certainly that was also very useful, but also in terms of giving a sufficient dose to actually attempt an eradication on the first trial, because that's important to help stop the development of resistance, I would have thought. So I would have thought that dosimetry would be a way to do it. One question with that, is dosimetry equally effectively done with limited CT capabilities, single slice spec CT, or even perhaps with attenuation correction systems? What do you think about that?
I don't think that anybody has really worked on that subject in depth, but just from a logical way of thinking, it seems that what you need from the CT part actually is just to be able to do the outline of the tumor of the your region of interest, your organ of interest, on one hand, and on the other hand, it appears that being able to do, as with quantitation with PET CT, being able to have attenuation-corrected images will make the difference. But again, this is a subject that requires a huge amount of research.
Yes, it's important people get on and do that research, and I think that's a very valuable thing in terms of not only in terms of achieving the maximum effective dose, but also many of these new agents are extremely expensive, so you only want to give the amount that's needed, and by doing accurate dosimetry, you can do that. One other thing you talked about was in PET CT was an interesting thing that was using use of the high fat diet. Perhaps you might talk a little bit about that.
I think that for that you should go to those who have really come up with the idea, who grabbed the finding that they saw in the clinical daily use and transformed it more into a. To a procedure, and this is the group at the Beth Israel Hospital in Harvard in Boston, Massachusetts, Jerry Kolodny and his colleagues. You know, sometimes you have the opportunity to stumble over something, and the whole idea to be have an open mind, open enough mind to be able to grab this opportunity. And their findings have certainly made a lot of waves in our imaging community and in the treating physicians community as well.
Yes, what we're referring to was reduction in brown fat uptake, which is always a nightmare for PET imaging, and also reduction in cardiac uptake. And leading on from that was perhaps by reducing the cardiac uptake, you could get some characterization of cardiac plaque. Perhaps you might want to tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, we again, just looking for our general PET CT images in patients with cancer, we noticed that there was some focal FDG uptake in the walls of large arteries, the aorta or carotid arteries. And we did some work showing that there was not necessarily a correlation between calcification in the walls of the arteries and the presence of FDG uptake. But furthermore, looking longitudinally in the same patients, those who had increased FDG uptake later on showed new calcifications. And that brought us and other researchers to the idea that we're actually stumbling over looking at the formation of what is called vulnerable atherosclerotic plaques. But we were well aware of our limitations of being unable to actually go further and study these findings in the coronary arteries because of the limitation related to FDG, physiologic FDG uptake in the myocardium. Now with the with administrating the fatty diet or the fatty drink to the patients prior to doing the study, you have eliminated this, or my colleagues at the Beth Israel Hospital have eliminated this major limitation, and clinicians and scientists will be able to assess the present and the natural history of vulnerable plaques in the coronary arteries, which is actually the most important thing to do.
Yes, everybody's talked about calcification and calcification in the coronary arteries, but often that's related to stable plaque that's been formed. It's the unstable plaque that's only recently being formed that's going to likely to produce a large number of coronary events. Thank you. That's been very interesting. I know you haven't been at the meeting long, but what are your highlights of the meeting so far, and what have you found from the meeting here in India?
This is actually my second meeting that I'm participating in India this year, and I'm highly impressed by the quality of the research being done and by the quality of the lectures and speakers. It is amazing how much can be done here. How much is being done here, and I think that Indian nuclear medicine is having a very important place in the global world of nuclear medicine. I think that there were two main areas that I was impressed with. One was the work and efforts that are being put into treatment with unsealed sources, mainly with lutetium components. And on the other hand, the vast possibilities that are available here because of the population that they see in working more on the use of nuclear medicine and hybrid imaging in infection. And this is something that we will all benefit later on if these studies will indeed succeed and they will be done in the appropriate way, as I believe they will be done.
Yes, well, speaking to many of the doctors from India, as it turns out, Israel's been very important to the development of nuclear medicine in India and helps provide, for example, a large proportion of the higher quality technetium or molybdenum here in India. I think there's a strong relationship there.
Yeah, there is. We have good relationships, both in terms of, I think, I'm not very familiar with the industry, but indeed it seems to be so. And lately we are developing very good relationships between researchers and clinicians. And I believe, and I want to believe, that things will go on like this, that we'll be able to establish common projects and be able to do some common research that will benefit the nuclear medicine community and our patients in general.
Yes, well, thank you very much. I'm sorry to take up so much of your time. I really appreciate giving you up your time to the podcast. Thank you very much for doing so.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And my pleasure also. Gee, there were some interesting topics that Professor Ori Israel brought up, and lots of potential for others to take up the challenge there. I'd love to hear from any of you at Boston or anywhere else that are doing the high-fat diet. I think to think about simple things like that that might be able to expand our use of PET, particularly looking at that early vulnerable plaque. And now that we've got lots of CT imaging for cardiac work that looks at calcium and so on, we really need to look at that early vulnerable plaque to see what's happening. And if PET can help to do that with FTG and high-fat diet, or can high-fat diet can help remove some of the artifacts with brown fat, that sounds a great way. So I'd love to hear from anybody who's doing that. I'd also like to hear from people who are looking at using dosimetry, using their SPECT CT systems, and what we started off with, which was the biopsy. I mean, that's such an obvious thing, but still not enough being done. I mean, biopsy, making sure that you're actually dealing with a functional part of a lesion when you biopsy it, so you don't end up with a sampling error. Exactly the same way as we think about that when we do sentinel node imaging to pick the right node. Very important. And, of course, when we're biopsying for infection, trying to find out what the root cause of infection is. So please, get back to me. I'd love to hear from you. And please, visit the website, nucast.com, where you can find out more. But until next time, we've got some interesting stuff next time. We're going off to another country to see what they do there. So we'll see you then. Bye then.